The stereotypical image of a ham radio operator is someone who is holed up in a basement and tinkering with electronics from a bygone era. But hold on there, that's not the case. The ham radio scene is robust. And in natural disasters and times of crisis, when phone lines and cell networks go down, ham radio operators are ready to assist. We're talking about the ham radio community here in Wisconsin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ham radio operators recently gathered in Waukesha to swap parts and make connections at the Midwinter Swap Fest. Mike Johnson is president of the West Allis Radio Amateur Club, which sponsored the Swap Fest for the 47th year. His call sign is WO9B. Mike, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Pleasure to be here.
And Patrick Moretti is with us as well. He is the Wisconsin section manager for the American Radio Relay League. His call sign is KA1RB. Patrick, thanks for being with us.
Well, good morning to you. I'm glad to be here.
So I said your call signs there, but help us understand what they mean and what they do. Patrick, can you explain call signs?
Well, I can a little bit. Originally, the call signs were designed to indicate the region that you were in. As an example, my call sign with a one in it indicates that I got my license in New England. With a nine or zero license, you got your license either in Minnesota or Colorado or one of the other areas that have a zero assigned to it. A two would be New York, Connecticut, New Jersey. Those are kind of regional assignments of the license number based on where you took your test, where you earned your license.
Are the letters then random, or how are they assigned?
Well, the first letters designate the United States. So we have calls that designate that K, the W, the K, the A are United States particular calls. A foreign call, for instance, a French call would start with an F. A German call would be with a G, I guess. The one in Russia would have a U in it. So there are different countries that would have different call bases. Those are all determined by the International Radio Union. That's the way that's set up.
Sure, Mike. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Mike. No, go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was going to Mike, I was going to say, you know, both of you are ham radio veterans, but can you help us with a working definition for ham radio novices? What is ham radio?
Oh, golly, ham radio is in its basic form, communicating via radio. So ham ideally would set up a transmitter and a receiver and go out and make contacts with other ham radio operators. In its very basic form, that's what ham radio operators do. That is a stepping stone, however, into far more complex communication techniques, schemes, everything from contest operations to network operations to very serious wise emergency communications and assisting government operations and whatnot, of which I suppose Puerto Rico, the situation in Puerto Rico kind of comes to mind as being the latest, greatest emergency event that ham radio operators played a large part in.
Yeah, help us understand the importance of ham radio operation in times of disaster.
Well, clearly, one of the facilities that ham radio lives in, so to speak, is we don't have the internet and we don't rely on necessarily on communication infrastructure that gets damaged or destroyed in emergency events. So a ham radio operator has a certain flexibility. He needs a power source and an antenna and some equipment and can then establish communications. And the real trick, though, is to establish communications in a useful way that helps facilitate emergency personnel, first responders, etc.
So what would be a useful way?
Well, for instance, one might set up a, going a bit technical here, a VHF link to facilitate voice operations between, say, first responders and a base station. One also might establish something called WinLink, which effectively offers data transfer via email without the use of the internet.
Talking with Mike Johnson, president of the West Allis Radio Amateur Club, and Patrick Moretti, who is the Wisconsin section manager for the American Radio Relay League, and gathering your stories about amateur radio. They are welcome at 800-642-1234. What led you to become a ham radio operator, and what's been your coolest contact? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Now, Patrick, do you, I understand that because ham radio is its own frequencies, can you actually broadcast on ham radio, or is it only making contacts?
Only making contacts. There are some forms of group transmissions that are authorized for emergency purposes or for training purposes, but generally, by the FCC rules, we are not allowed to broadcast as such. So it's person-to-person contact or person-to-group contact for amateur radio.
And Patrick, you have to be licensed and take a test.
That is correct. We have to have there are three different classes of amateur radio, three different levels, I guess you could call them, for amateur radio. You start off as a technician, that is the what we'll call an entry level, which includes a test that checks your some technical base, and mostly consists of understanding rules and regulations that you're going to have to follow. Some basic electronics, some basic communication skills. Then there's a general test, license for general, which gives you privileges that are beyond the technician privileges that increase the range of your radios and the power of your radios. Actually, not anymore. That the entry level is allowed the full power. So, but generals will have the ability to reach quite a bit further with the types of radios they are able to use.
And hundreds of thousands.
That is more technical.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Hundreds of thousands of people have taken this test. It sounds as if there are a lot of licensees out there.
In Wisconsin, we have 1,700 plus. Licensed amateur radio operators, so that are members of the ARRL, that are actually members of our society. So, yes, there are many in the United States overall. I can't think of the actual number. Maybe Mike has that number. I don't have that data.
Well, there are radio stations at frequencies assigned to the amateur radio or ham radio, and the FCC, as we've been talking about, regulates these frequencies. Hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. have taken the test to be licensed ham operators. We're understanding more about ham radio and the community here in Wisconsin on the morning show. Your questions and stories are welcome at 800-642-1234. Are you a ham radio operator? Have you ever helped out with emergency communications during a crisis? Or have you met a fascinating stranger? Call in. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute here on the Ideas Network. A shout out to Riverland Amateur Radio Club in Onalaska. It's winter field days, the weekend of January 26th. That's when members brave the cold and see how many contacts they can make with other ham operators. We're talking about the ham radio community on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Mike Johnson and Patrick Moretti stay with us. Mike is president of the West Allis Radio Amateur Club. Patrick is the Wisconsin section manager for the American Radio Relay League. And you can join in 800-642-1234. So what's the most interesting thing that's ever happened to you on your ham radio? Who's the most interesting ham radio operator you ever met? Call in, bring on your stories, 800-642-1234. So Patrick, let's start with you. What is the most interesting experience you've had doing ham radio? Looking back through the years, what's been a memorable thing that sticks out to you?
Well, one of the things we have to understand is that just about the excitement of making contacts with strangers is one of the driving points here. Every contact is kind of you throw a line into a big pond and you try to catch a fish. So that's kind of been an exciting aspect of ham radio for me. One of the most exciting ones was when my family and I were camping out on Cape Cod. Well, camping is kind of a hard way to say, because it was kind of late November, early December, and that's kind of a harsh area to be in for that time of year. But my kids and I were out there, and the tent was all set up. We were outside at night. It was beautiful, beautiful dark sky. And we saw this light go across the sky. Well, my kids were, you know, look up and say, "What's that?" And, you know, that's probably the space shuttle. It had gone up. I think it was Columbia that had gone up at that time, and was up there. I said, "Well, what, how do you know that?" I said, "Well, let's see if I can call them." So, you know, but they did look at me kind of, "What are you talking about?" Call them. No, so I pulled on my little radio, and I went ahead and put out a call to the shuttle. I said, "Hey, can you guys hear me? This is KA1RB." And sure enough, I got an answer. And it was the one astronaut on that flight was W5LFL Owen. And we had a very short conversation. He was pretty well gone by the time we actually established contact. But what I can say about that is my kids' eyes were wide open.
That is incredible. What a story. And I'm sure that will still amaze your kids for years to come. I mean, they can't top that.
Absolutely not. No.
Dad placed a call to space. All right. Well, that's a tough act to follow, Mike.
Oh, that is a tough act to follow. That's a wonderful story. I won't even try to top it. That's just too good. But one of the CUSOs that jumps to my mind, and just it kind of typifies a ham radio conversation, was speaking with a gentleman in Sweden who was convinced that the U.S. had gotten rid of Idaho for some reason. And so we spent a 15 or 20 minutes trying to find Idaho on a map. It was very entertaining, and what a wonderful conversation with someone from a foreign country. And that kind of typifies one of the experiences that one bumps into being a ham radio operator. It's a lot of fun and typically light type conversations and entertaining and frankly educational. But Patrick's story has got me beat. I got to say, congrats, Pat.
Let's bring in a call now. Let's go to Joe, who's joining us from Appleton. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. I wanted to make the point that I have never had an amateur radio license. I've always been in it for 40 years or more, listening as a shortwave listener. And one of the experiences I had was the fact of realizing that it's not the strength of the signal, but the strategy of how you get it out. I had known an operator who used 0.5 watt of power to get to Russia to propagate a signal. And the conditions had to be right. The antenna had to be right. That's why amateur radio is a hobby. It was the ability to build something to propagate a signal across the world or to whatever location, depending on how skilled you were in understanding the dynamics of radio propagation. So I listen to these guys all the time. I have equipment. I've just never been able to get up there and get that license. I think now that I'm retired, I'll be able to do that. But that's the difference between amateur radio and the Internet. Everybody says, well, we have the Internet today. We can contact anybody. Well, it's like what he said about throwing a line in the pond. You may pick up some interesting contacts you never thought you could. You can't do that on the Internet. You have to have a specific destination before you can do that. Amateur radio is the ability to contact anybody at any time in any condition using a piece of equipment you designed or you built or an antenna you built to get that signal out there. That was the big skill. That was the big challenge of it.
Joe, thank you so much for the call and can't wait to hear. Patrick, what is your response to that?
Well, that's wonderful. That's actually quite wonderful. And anytime you want help getting your license, we'll be more than happy to get you set up. There are a couple of very active clubs in the Appleton area, and I'm sure they'd be really looking forward to having you as a member. It sounds like you have a lot of good technical background and certainly the interest. That's great.
Mike, let's probe that a little bit more. Even in the age of the Internet, we really still need ham radio.
Oh, I absolutely couldn't agree more with that. It's traditionally called the radio arts and underscore arts. It's not just something you go and buy a box, set it on your desk and have success at. It's not the case. It takes a fair amount of work. It is a hobby, and it's supposed to be enjoyable, and oftentimes it is, but I can attest, as every ham is, Ken, that that's not always the case. It's a challenging, it's fun, it's rewarding, and it's very, very different than... as the caller pointed out, it's not shooting fish in a barrel. It's as Patrick said, it's casting your bait into the pond, and sometimes you get a hit and sometimes you don't.
Let's bring in Dan now, who's joining us from Milwaukee with a story. Dan, hi.
I grew up in Detroit, and my father and mother were both ham radio operators. His company left Detroit and moved across the state to Muskegon. And my mom and dad kept in touch by ham radio. And then when I went to college in 1957 at Marquette in Milwaukee, my father would call a ham radio operator just to harass me in the mornings to make sure I didn't spend too much time in watering holes around town. He would get me up at 8 o'clock on Sunday mornings or thereabouts. And they would put in what's known as a phone patch and patch the radio call from my dad. He called another amateur operator in Milwaukee who would put together a phone patch and call me in the dormitory until finally somebody got the phone call some Saturday or Sunday morning at 6 a.m. or something like that and explained to him that this telephone wasn't my telephone. It was in the dormitory at Trader Hall, and it served four rooms, and he woke everybody up at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, that is a brilliant story. Dan, thank you so much. Patrick, ham radio, keeping families together and up on the weekend.
Absolutely. Now, that's one of the things that amateur radio did for the military, actually. Nowadays, they go ahead and they have Internet connections, and they are very directly connected. But there are still amateur radio operators that volunteer to provide communications to between soldiers and their homes. The idea of the phone patch was what brought that to my mind. When I was in Vietnam, as an example, I was able to talk to my wife through amateur radio. There were military affiliates would set up a radio connection between Vietnam and somewhere in the United States, and a radio volunteer would take that that connection and add a phone patch to it so that the family could actually talk. And I remember my wife being trained to say over between the conversations. When you finished a sentence, you had to say over so that the our radio operator would know to switch the transmission.
Well, this has been so much fun, and unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Well, thanks, Kate. Really enjoyed it.
Mike Johnson is president of the West Allis Radio Amateur Club. His call sign is WO9B. And Patrick Moretti is the Wisconsin section manager for the American Radio Relay League. Has called an astronaut, and his call sign is KA1RB. Coming up next, our guest says that climate change is a public health crisis, and we'll dive into the way climate change impacts human health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The World Health Organization estimates air pollution kills 7 million people worldwide every year, and 9 out of 10 people breathe air containing high levels of pollutants. We're looking at what a warming planet is doing to our health on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dr. Jonathan Patz thinks about this a lot as the director of the Global Health Institute at UW-Madison. He is a professor and the John P. Holton Chair in Health and the Environment. He was a lead author for the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for over a decade. That's the organization that shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore in 2007. Dr. Patz, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Kate, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So what do we get when we frame climate change as something about us, a public health issue, as opposed to focusing on polar bears, as a focusing on rising sea levels or increasing temperatures?
Well, that's a great question, and I've been working on that for more than two decades. Climate change, it's real, it's here, it's today. Most importantly, it's not just affecting the polar bears, it's affecting us and our health. And there are so many pathways through which climate affects our health, from direct effects of heat waves to stagnant air masses and worsening air pollution, extremes in the water cycle, so more floods, more droughts, and more fires, malnutrition, and effects on infectious diseases, especially those carried by insects like mosquito-borne Zika virus or dengue fever. So there are so many ways that climate affects our health that I personally view this as the largest environmental public health crisis of our times.
Do you think that focusing on the repercussions of climate change hitting us, impacting human health, does that help people get a better handle on the issue and maybe take it more seriously?
I do. I think everyone cares about the health of themselves and their children and grandchildren, and I think that there's much more common ground when you understand that climate change is about us. It's about our health. The faces of climate change are not those of just endangered species, which I think are very important in themselves, but the fact that when you see that climate change can exacerbate asthma and problems with children or infectious diseases and malnutrition. This is something that we must understand. Climate change is about our health.
We always hear that climate change affects people who are marginalized more than it impacts those who have more money, more resources, and that countries doing the most polluting aren't going to bear the brunt of climate change. What have you found in your research about how that works?
Interesting question. I'd say yes and no. Yes, absolutely, that those most vulnerable are also the least responsible for causing the problem. The industrialized countries have been, the United States is the number one responsible country for today's climate change with all of our greenhouse gas emissions from burning fossil fuels. But Climate change affects all of us, and in a globalized world, increases in climate-sensitive diseases anywhere in the world affects everyone. But that it is true that, you know, people that don't have shelter, exposed to more of the extreme climatic conditions, and people that have diabetes or no air conditioning, you know, these people are at higher risk. And the World Health Organization estimates that more than 80% of climate change-related diseases will affect children.
What do we know about countries that are the worst polluters, and what parts of the world have experienced the most negative consequences of climate change?
Well, certainly when you think about developing countries that have lots of diarrheal disease and poor sanitation conditions, these are countries that are already suffering. Places that have malnutrition, it's estimated that the 800 million people around the world at risk of climate change, at risk of malnutrition, that number will double by mid-century simply from the effects of warming temperatures on crops and crop yields. Places that have malaria. Malaria is a very sensitive disease to climate shifts. These are places that are already seeing more increases in disease. But don't forget that we're not immune to this. And in Wisconsin, for example, it's warmed 1 degree Fahrenheit already since the 1950s. Our ragweed pollen season has lengthened almost more than 2 weeks. So there are places, you know, in the wealthy countries that are also going to be hit by climate change and effects on ill health.
We're talking with Dr. Jonathan Patz. He is the director of the Global Health Institute at UW-Madison. Gathering your questions on climate change and public health, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Have you dealt with health consequences related to pollution or climate change? What's your story? What do you think can be done to deal with public health issues related to climate change, like insect-borne disease, water contamination, and air pollution? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Patz, as you look at climate change and the impact on human health, what about the potential impact on mental health? How does climate change have an impact on someone's mental health?
Yes, this is something that we've been looking at more and more recently. It's a big issue when you think about storm disasters and post-traumatic stress syndrome. Just the last year, we had 16 extreme weather disasters in the United States. Hurricane Maria that hit Puerto Rico killed somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000, although the official official count was only 64, but the studies show somewhere between 3,000 to 5,500 deaths. So the trauma from these disasters is enormous. And then the concern about, you know, simply young people thinking about, you know, growing up in a world that's plagued by climate change and the disasters that emerge, this is causing some anxiety.
So recently, about 24 scientists, they reviewed thousands of peer-reviewed scientific papers. They were looking at climate change and its impact on human health and food supplies and water and a whole bunch of things. And that was published in the journal Nature Climate Change. I'm just wondering, why did they need to go back through all of this research and try to look at climate change and quantify and assess and compartmentalize its impact in so many different areas?
Yeah, great question. And I think the essence is that some of the indirect effects can be larger than the obvious ones. So, for example, we know that people die in heat waves. And in the United States, heat waves are getting more frequent and longer, on average 4 days longer than they were back 40 years ago. And we know that people die in heat waves. But what about drought disasters that destabilize populations already on the edge? It's been shown that right before the Syrian Civil War, with, you know, there was the worst drought in the instrumental record, and it forced rural to urban migration rates 4 to 5 times higher than normal into the cities in Syria. There were food price shocks, there were riots in the streets. So some of these indirect effects that can be destabilizing of an entire population need to be recognized. So when you look at climate change effects on health, you can't just look at single exposure, dose response, and count the numbers. You need to look at a lot of the cross-sectoral indirect effects that could be enormous when you add them up. And that's why that study was conducted, to look at all of the ways and the intricate ways in which climate change can affect us.
Let's bring in Mike now, joining us from DeForest. Mike, hi. What are your thoughts?
I have heard or read somewhere that, like, during the Wild West days, there was malaria up as far north as St. Louis. Anything to that? And hot weather?
Thank you, Mike. Yeah, malaria.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a question that's come up before, and it's all about the biological system that includes the mosquito that carries malaria. And it's something called the vectorial capacity. And the vectorial capacity of Anopheles mosquitoes in the United States was back then just barely above one, which means that one infected person can lead to one more case, and so on. In places like Africa, where you've got tropical climates, the vectorial capacity is so high because of climatic conditions that if you do some environmental changes and drain a few swamps, you still have malaria. And so in the United States, when we just barely had malaria, it was very easy to eradicate it. So that's the difference between places in the tropics versus in temperate climates regarding vector-borne diseases like malaria.
How prone are we to a malaria outbreak here in the U.S. today?
Another great question. You know, these vector-borne diseases are very sensitive to small changes in climate. And so when people say, look, you live in Wisconsin, it's 10 below zero in the winter and it's 90 degrees in the summer, who cares about 1 or 2 degrees shift in temperature? If you have a mosquito-borne disease, a half a degree or 1 degree increase warming can make a difference in transmission. And in many cases, it's the warmer temperatures that are causing higher epidemics. And so it's all about the parasite inside the cold-blooded mosquito. You change whatever the air temperature is, that's the body temperature of the mosquito. So a small shift in temperature can have a huge change in the transmission dynamics of mosquito-borne diseases.
We're looking at the human health consequences of climate change here on The Morning Show. Dr. Jonathan Patz is our guide. He directs the Global Health Institute at UW-Madison. Gathering your questions, your insights, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Do you have health problems that are connected to pollution or climate change? What do you think can be done to deal with public health issues related to climate change, like insect-borne disease, water contamination, and air pollution? You can call in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network.
In the WPR weather forecast for today, cloudy skies, some flurries possible across central and southern Wisconsin with gusty winds, highs in the 30s with temperatures falling through the afternoon. Clearing off on Wednesday, a few flurries in the north, breezy and highs from the upper teens to low 20s. On Thursday, partly sunny with highs in the low to mid 20s. And Friday, increasing clouds, snow developing from north to south with some light accumulations possible in the north, highs in the 20s and 30s.
Coming up, the number of Americans who volunteered last year jumped by almost one quarter compared to a couple years ago. After 7, we look at new national data on volunteerism and how Milwaukee is a leader in lending a hand. About 24 scientists reviewed more than 3,000 peer-reviewed scientific papers. They were looking at climate change and its impact on human health, on our food supplies, water, the economy, infrastructure, security. The work was published in the journal Nature Climate Change in November, and it's been billed as one of the most comprehensive assessments of how humanity is being impacted. Dr. Jonathan Patz is our guide to this conversation. He directs UW-Madison's Global Health Institute, and he was a lead author for the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for more than a decade. Your questions on the climate crisis, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Are you managing a health problem that has a direct correlation to polluted air or climate change? What are you doing on an individual level to cope with climate change and to stay healthy? You can call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Patz, before we move into looking at solutions, you wanted to make mention of Zika and mosquitoes. Where are we with that and climate change?
Yeah, the prior caller asked about malaria, and I just wanted to point out that the El Nino of 2015 and 16 was one of the strongest in history, and the extreme temperatures were so high in Brazil and Colombia. There were some studies done on the effect of that temperature on the mosquito that carries dengue fever and Zika virus, and it was found that those temperature conditions were the most favorable for transmission in the last 60 years. So I think that that extreme El Nino event may have been in part responsible for the rise of Zika virus in South America.
So as we are looking at climate change and what to do about it, a lot of times we look to fossil fuels, we look to transportation. How are you looking at solutions here?
Well, when you think about the primary cause of climate change, it's burning fossil fuels. And that causes the greenhouse gases that warm up the planet. But also when you burn coal and oil and gas, you release dangerous pollutants that we know harm people, especially the fine particles, PM2.5, that kill 7 million people, according to the World Health Organization, every year. In the United States, almost 100,000 people still die, even though we have the Clean Air Act. So if you can get to a low-carbon economy and get off of coal and oil, you'll have not only mitigating effects on climate and stabilize the Earth's climate, but you'll have immediate health benefits through cleaner air. And also, if we design cities for people rather than just motorized vehicles, you'll promote more physical activity. So there are some immediate gains. You know, it's important for people to realize climate change, it's real, it's here, but the solutions to get to a low-carbon economy could be the greatest health opportunity of our times. I mean, think about chronic diseases like diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. These are related to the physical activity is one thing, as well as diet. 60% of Americans don't even meet the minimal levels of recommended exercise. So here's a golden opportunity to solve the climate problem, but at the same time have these health co-benefits immediately.
What have you found in your research on switching out short car trips for biking?
Well, we found that just that small intervention of taking short bike trips that are, you know, less than 2.5 miles, and only in metropolitan areas in the upper Midwest, the 11 largest cities in the upper Midwest, would save about 1,300 lives every year and $8 billion in avoided mortality and health costs. So, you know, swapping tailpipes for pedals, small intervention and huge health benefit. And these types of studies have been repeated around the world with many benefits there.
Let's go to Jess now, joining us from La Crosse. Jess, hi, go ahead.
Hi, so my question was, with like the rise in global temperatures, have we seen an increase in the amount of cases of Lyme disease from deer ticks in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, that's a tough question. It's a great question. Lyme disease is a vector-borne disease, and therefore the tick, which is a cold-blooded insect, is responsible for transmission. It's sensitive to the climate. But it's a complicated story with Lyme disease, thinking about land use change, deforestation, hunting and deer, and I have to say that it has been found that Lyme disease is shifting northward into Canada, especially into deciduous forests in Canada. So there's a discernible change in the geographic distribution of Lyme disease moving north. But in Wisconsin and Minnesota, it's a very complex situation. Hard to answer that one.
Let's go to Victor now with a question in West Allis. Victor, hi.
Hi. Good evening, Congressman. A little quick question. I'm 73 years old. In 1968, it was not unusual to get like 25 below zero lasting for 4 or 5 days. Also, what was consistent is the weather change, that on New Year's Eve, you can have sub-zero weather or 18 inches of snow, which closed down a lot of events. But I noticed the change started in 1980, where you didn't have these kind of severe weather. What's your opinion on that?
So that's a great question. That I leave that for the climatologists, people like John Magnuson, who have studied the shortening freezing season, and Lake Mendota here has been frozen over far fewer, like 25% less than it used to be. One important message, though, is that to remember that global climate change is global, and that the Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the world. So as the globe is warming, we are still going to be seeing some weird climate, especially as the Arctic warms up and the polar vortex, the jet stream, deviates more and more. So we'll be seeing warming, but we'll also be seeing extreme cold temperatures as we did in 2012. When the polar vortex swept way down into Atlanta, Georgia, and those areas. So don't just look outside the window and locally to say, aha, it's warm or it's cold. We have to recognize this is a global average issue that we're going to be seeing plenty of cold temperatures, but in general, the Earth is warming, and that's going to be more problematic as we move into the future.
Dr. Patz, how do you get movement from people and policymakers to look at climate change in a more urgent way, particularly since the biggest culprits, including the U.S., don't have to perhaps deal with the biggest consequences right now?
Well, I think, you know, you have to look at how many ways climate change can affect an area and focus in on those specific regions. For example, Chicago, we looked at the combined sewage overflow events that happen when you have extreme rainfall, and we found you'd have a doubling in these events because of extremes of the water cycle. And so that people need to recognize that climate will affect them in many ways. Our trout streams are threatened, and people care about trout. And of course, the other thing is when we think about how do we act on climate change, we think, well, we'll just adapt to it. Let's turn on the air conditioners. We just did a study that showed that if our electricity comes from 30% coal, in the eastern United States, when you turn on the air conditioners for predicted increases in heat waves, you're going to kill an extra 1,000 people from the pollution from those being sourced by dirty coal. So those are things that really need to be thought about. As far as getting movement at the policy level, you know, even though our federal government is sort of stalling out on the issue, there are there's a compact of mayors, there's the C40 cities, we are still in. That's more than 150 million Americans on board, and $10 trillion of our U.S. economy talking about, you know, climate change. It's real. We need to take it seriously. Healthcare systems, the healthcare without harm, and green hospitals are coming on board. So lots is happening at the local level, and I think people just not have to realize that. You know, the scientific debate of about climate change, it's no longer a scientific debate. The climatologists are
in consensus.
There's real consensus there. It's just political debate.
Dr. Patz, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Kate.
Dr. Jonathan Patz is director of the Global Health Institute at UW-Madison. He's a professor in the John P. Holton Chair in Health and the Environment. He served as a lead author for the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and that's the organization that shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore in 2007. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.